Picture this. You're sitting at this really upscale Mediterranean restaurant.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, there's a plate of, smoky baba ganoush on the table right in front of you. And you are laughing, snapping a quick photograph of your son getting carded as he orders his first legal adult beverage.
Right, for his 21st birthday.
Exactly. It's this incredibly intimate, joyous family milestone. But right outside the glass window of the restaurant, the scene is just completely different.
A totally different reality.
Yeah. A massive crowd of protesters has gathered. They are beating drums. They are screaming into megaphones. So inside, you have this quiet, beautifully curated celebration of family. But outside, you have the chaotic, totally unfiltered roar of global politics pressing right up against the glass.
It is a wild clash of realities. Adam actually describes it in his notes as a very American cocktail. It's this strange mixture of personal milestones and public unrest all being served up at the exact same moment.
It really is.
Yeah.
And before we get too deep into that, I just want to officially welcome you to this deep dive. I'll take a quick second to orient you. What you are listening to today is an AI-generated conversational podcast-style reading of what Adam is reading.
Right, which is a fantastic
It
resource.
really is. For those who don't know, it's a weekly review of articles, research, and other fascinating ephemera that's been compiled for colleagues and friends who are exploring data and healthcare. And this has been going on since March 2020.
A long time now.
Yeah, over 6 years. Adam's the author of the newsletter and the commentary. He actually hand-selected every single article we were going to discuss today for his readers, and he uses Claude to help improve his writing clarity and for fact-checking.
Which is such a smart way to use these new tools.
Absolutely. And just so you know, all past issues are available for you to check out at whatadamisreading.com. We are going to review his selected articles in order today, and we've actually clicked through all the source links and retrieved the full articles, just so we can give you the complete picture.
Yeah, we really dug into the primary sources, and that restaurant scene you mentioned, it acts as the perfect anchor for our mission today.
It really sets the stage.
It does. Because what we are exploring in this deep dive is the concept of curating reality.
Curating reality. I like that.
Right. Because life throws an overwhelming amount of messy data at you every single day. I mean, sometimes that data is a loud political protest outside a window. Sometimes it's a massive convoluted medical study. Or, it's the language we choose to communicate with, or even the art we hang on our walls.
Right. It's all just raw information.
Exactly. And we want to look at how all that raw, unfiltered reality gets filtered, regulated, and arranged by the systems and the people around us.
Well, let's start with the big systems. Let's look at how the medical establishment attempts to build filters around really messy biological data. There's a massive new cohort study making headlines this week regarding the healthcare economics of Zepbound.
Right, which is the brand name for the GLP-1 drug tirzepatide.
Exactly. And the big multi-billion dollar question with these weight loss drugs has always been, well, yes, they are incredibly expensive upfront, but does the resulting weight loss eventually pay for itself by preventing other health issues down the line?
Yeah, that's the holy grail of preventative medicine. And this new study claims to have found the definitive answer.
Or so they say.
Right. They looked at a very specific cohort. Adults over 55 who are obese or overweight with a related condition, but crucially, they do not have diabetes.
Okay, so a very specific slice of the population.
Very specific. And the headline finding that is just being broadcast everywhere is that patients who started tirzepatide between November 2023 and September 2025 eventually saw their healthcare costs drop by $319 a month.
Wow, $319.
Yeah, and that's specifically at the 12 to 18-month mark.
Okay, but I'm looking at Adam's notes here, and he points out two massive red flags with that number. First, the paper attributes that $319 mostly to a reduction in hospitalizations. But if you actually dig into their own supplementary data, that hospitalization signal just fades away under deeper analysis.
It completely evaporates, yeah.
Right. And second, and honestly, maybe more importantly, that $319 savings figure completely excludes the actual cost of the drug itself.
Which is wild. It's fascinating how aggressively the data was filtered before it ever reached the public.
How so?
Well, first, just look at the authorship. Every single author on this paper is either a Lilly employee or a contractor paid by Lilly.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's a huge filter right there.
Exactly. But second, let's look at the actual mechanism of the study's participant drop-off, because this is where the filter becomes, frankly, a distortion.
Okay, walk me through it.
The GLP-1 treated arm started with 15,843 people, but by the time they hit that 12 to 18 month mark where the savings supposedly appear, the pool had shrunk to just 11,181 participants.
Wait, hold on. Over 14,000 people just vanished from the data.
Yep, they were gone.
How does a study lose 90% of its participants and still get published with that kind of definitive headline?
Well, it happens because of how the timeline itself was constructed. Over 60% of the cohort started taking the drug in 2025, but the data collection stopped in September 2025.
Oh, I see.
Right. So a huge chunk of people simply ran out of time in the study before they could ever reach month 12.
They literally couldn't hit the milestone.
Exactly. And when you combine that with the natural real-world discontinuation rate, you know, people dropping out because of nausea or cost, you are left with just 1,181 people.
So these are the survivors, basically.
Yes. They are the absolute most dedicated early adopters. They are not at all representative of the broader population that Medicare is likely to actually enroll.
Well, let's talk about Medicare, because this brings up the whole Medicare Bridge program.
Right, the Bridge program.
This is the initiative currently extending coverage to Medicare patients who don't have a traditional qualifying indication, like diabetes or sleep apnea. But looking at the timeline, the Bridge program only has funding from July 2026 through December 2027.
Which is just an 18-month window.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, the financial math for the patient is basically an illusion.
Completely. Because the published savings don't even begin to materialize until month 12.
Right. So if a patient wants to see any benefit during that Bridge program, they have to enroll on day one, in month one. Anyone starting the drug in early 2027 is going to age out of the program before any financial offset even happens.
It's a logistical trap.
It is. And hold on. So you're telling me a patient pays into this, but who actually captures that $319? I mean, the patient is paying a $50 monthly copay. Do they see any of that savings?
None of it. The patient captures exactly $0.
That is wild.
Yeah, all of that $319 accrues back to Medicare and other payers. The negotiated price for the Bridge program is $245 a month, and that includes the patient's $50 copay.
Wow.
So that means the net cost to Medicare is $195 a month. Adam actually argues that if these supposed savings are real, CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they should just fund the drug entirely.
Just pay for it.
Right. Run the program long enough to actually harvest those savings rather than putting the financial burden on the patient.
It is a perfect example of a system building a filter that effectively isolates the patient from the actual benefit.
Absolutely.
And we are seeing another institutional filter just totally breaking down this week with the FDA's approval of the 2026 to 2027 COVID vaccines.
Oh, the new rollout. Yeah, this is interesting.
Right. So the FDA just cleared Pfizer's Comirnaty, both of Moderna's mRNA products, Spikevax and mNEXSPIKE, and Novavax's non-mRNA option, which is Nuvaxovid, marketed by Sanofi.
A lot of options this year.
There are. But the target here is really specific. They are targeting the XFG variant, which is nicknamed Stratus. Now, Adam's notes say XFG is only responsible for about 6% of cases right now.
That's right, just 6%.
So why would the FDA mandate a vaccine for a variant that's causing such a tiny fraction of the infections?
Because XFG is what we call a JN.1 lineage recombinant.
A recombinant. What does that mean in plain English?
So a recombinant variant happens when two different strains of a virus infect the exact same host cell at the exact same time, and they essentially swap genetic material to create a hybrid.
Like a viral mashup.
Exactly. So while XFG itself is only 6% of cases, its evolutionary descendants variants, like SW.2, make up about 60% of the currently sequenced cases.
Okay, that makes sense.
Right. By targeting the parent recombinant, the vaccine provides broad coverage against the entire sprawling family tree of its descendants.
That makes total sense biologically, but the regulatory side is where the filter just completely falls apart. The criteria to actually get one of these shots is incredibly convoluted now.
It is a mess.
Right. So if you're 65 or older, you qualify automatically. But if you are younger than 65, you need to have at least one condition that raises your risk of severe COVID.
And that list of conditions is fascinating.
It is. Because the list includes things you would totally expect, like asthma, diabetes, immune deficiency, cancer. But it also includes things like certain mental health conditions and, get this, physical inactivity.
Physical inactivity.
Okay, let's unpack this. If simply being physically inactive is an official on-label qualification for a vaccine, hasn't the FDA essentially created a regulatory loophole so big you could drive a truck through it?
That is exactly the unintended consequence here. Institutions desperately try to create these rigid, objective, quantifiable rules for biological realities that are inherently fluid and messy.
Biology hates rigid rules.
It really does. And when they attempt to force that rigidity, they end up with convoluted systems. Depending on how you interpret the data, between 30 and 60% of all Americans have a qualifying condition under these new rules.
Up to 60%.
Yeah. Attesting to being physically inactive isn't a workaround anymore. It is the official label.
That is just wild to think about.
As Adam points out, the concepts of on-label and off-label have quietly just collapsed into each other. Up to 200 million people qualify. The FDA built a rigid filter to restrict access, and in doing so, they completely broke their own filter.
It is so wild to see an institution trip over its own rules like that. But, you know, if that is what happens when institutions build flawed filters, what happens when brilliant people just reject the establishment entirely and try to build their own realities?
Oh, this is a great pivot.
Yeah, Adam was listening to an interview on the All In podcast with Eric Weinstein.
Right, the mathematician turned investor. And just to clarify, no relation to Adam.
No relation. Yeah, Adam noted that listening to the beginning of this interview felt like yoga for the mind.
Yoga for the mind. I love that description.
It really fits. Weinstein is incredibly articulate. And he starts with premises that are actually quite grounded. He points out that scientific breakthroughs have really stagnated in many areas.
Which is a valid observation.
Very valid. He argues that academic institutions have become highly dysfunctional and that the peer review process can sometimes act as a form of intellectual gatekeeping.
Gatekeeping that marginalizes highly original, nonconformist ideas.
Right. And I think a lot of people would agree with that. I mean, if AI and geopolitics are accelerating at this crazy pace, maybe we do need to look outside traditional academia for disruptive innovation.
Absolutely. It's a compelling argument.
But Adam says that about 15 minutes in, the intellectual yoga class turned into a circus sideshow.
Yeah, it takes a sharp left turn. Because Weinstein takes this massive, unsupported slide from valid systemic critique straight into conspiracy theory.
It escalated quickly.
He starts suggesting that elite scientists are secretly conducting classified work on breakthrough physics, propulsion, and UAP's unidentified anomalous phenomena.
Basically UFOs.
Right, UFOs. And when the hosts press him on where the secret cabal is operating, Weinstein points to Renaissance Technologies.
Wait, Renaissance Technologies?
Yeah.
The hedge fund.
Yes. A massive, highly successful hedge fund based on Long Island.
That is so random.
And the moment he says it, he immediately starts backpedaling. He says, oh, I'm not saying it's them. I'm just saying they have a secure campus with a story that makes no sense.
Wow. Adam observed that Weinstein sounds incredibly bitter about being slighted by the conventional academic world. But why do brilliant minds fall into these traps?
Well, this raises a really important question about the psychology of isolation. When someone with immense intellect is marginalized by their peers, and that can be fairly or unfairly, the psychological defense mechanism is often to assume that the system isn't just flawed, but actively hiding the truth.
Right, it's a defense mechanism.
Exactly. If you can't succeed within the establishment, you just convince yourself the establishment is a front.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Weinstein is using the language of legitimate scientific inquiry, but it feels like wrapping a grocery store tabloid in the cover of a peer-reviewed medical journal.
That is a perfect analogy.
I mean, he is taking guilty pleasure YouTube topics like hidden physics and aliens and dressing them up in serious academic jargon like heterodoxy.
It is a very dangerous cultural moment we're in. Questioning assumptions is obviously vital for progress, but we have reached this zeitgeist where mere speculation just effortlessly masquerades as data.
Yes, the whole do your own research thing.
Exactly. The act of doing your own research on the internet is suddenly being equated with decades of institutional expertise. Adam accurately describes him as a smarter Joe Rogan.
A smarter Joe Rogan.
A carnival barker who defends massive leaps in logic by just claiming he is just asking questions.
He is using complex language to completely obscure reality. But on the flip side, there is a totally different trend happening right now, where society is actively trying to simplify and outsource our language.
You're talking about the Druckenmiller op-ed.
Yes. Stanley Druckenmiller, the legendary financier, recently published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal heavily criticizing Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent.
And readers immediately noticed something was off.
Oh, instantly. The text was completely riddled with obvious AI-isms.
It was clearly generated by a large language model.
Right. But when people called him out on it, Druckenmiller completely refused to be embarrassed. He publicly stated, "I write everything using AI now for the same reason I use a calculator when I do math problems."
And the editorial page editor of the journal actually defended him. They called AI a fact of modern life.
I have to push back on Druckenmiller's defense here. Is writing an op-ed with AI really like using a calculator to solve a math problem? Or is it more like asking the calculator to decide which equations are worth solving in the first place?
That is the exact distinction. What's fascinating here is that he completely misses the fundamental nature of writing. Writing is not just the transcription of thought. Writing is thinking.
Right. It's the process itself.
It is the process of discovering what you actually believe by wrestling with how to express it. If you outsource the writing to an algorithm, you are fundamentally outsourcing your cognitive agency.
You're letting the machine do the thinking.
Exactly. And you can contrast his lazy use of AI with this amazing concept a reader sent in to Adam called ASDTE100,
right,
or Simplified Technical English.
I found this part so interesting. It's an aerospace industry standard.
Yes.
And it's a strictly controlled vocabulary containing exactly 900 approved words governed by 53 rigid rules. My first thought was, why would the aerospace industry intentionally restrict their vocabulary that drastically?
Because of the mechanism of safety.
Mm-hmm.
The mechanics reading aerospace maintenance manuals all over the world, well, they often do not speak English as their first language.
Right. The manuals require constant translation.
Exactly. And a misinterpreted adjective in an airplane manual isn't a stylistic flaw. It is a catastrophic safety failure.
People could die.
Right. The committee that built this standard engineered all ambiguity completely out of the language on purpose to save lives.
So simplifying technical English deliberately narrows language to protect human life.
Hmm.
But Druckenmiller narrowed his language with generative AI just to save 20 minutes on a Tuesday. It totally reminds me of George Orwell's famous 1946 essay, Politics and the English Language. Orwell had these incredibly strict rules for authors. Rule number one was never use a metaphor, simile, or other figure of speech which you are used to seeing in print.
And that is exactly where the architecture of large language models directly clashes with Orwellian philosophy.
Because of how they're trained.
Right. LLMs are, at their core, statistical prediction engines. They predict the next token based on its frequency in their training data. By definition, an LLM reaches for the phrasing it has seen the most often.
It defaults to the cliche.
Inherently, it defaults to Orwell's first forbidden rule. It is quite literally an engine designed to produce cliches.
That is so true. Adam actually brings in Neil Postman's synthesis from Amusing Ourselves to Death here.
A classic book.
Such a good book. Postman pointed out that George Orwell feared the state would forcefully strip away our words to control our thoughts. But Aldous Huxley, in Brave New World, feared something worse. He feared that the public would just voluntarily stop wanting to use words at all.
And we are landing in a reality squarely between those two fears. I mean, the state isn't banning anything. We get to keep all the words in the dictionary.
We have all the words.
But we are voluntarily handing the actual sentence construction over to an AI tool.
Yep.
And that tool statistically homogenizes our unique voices into a flat, mean average of ideas. We are transitioning from being authors of our own thoughts to just being lazy editors of a machine's output.
Yeah.
And we're doing it all while congratulating ourselves on how efficiently we use our new calculator.
We are voluntarily giving up our mental agency.
We really are.
Well, let's look at the complete opposite of that. Let's talk about the involuntary curation of our own biology.
Oh, the kidney stone story.
Yes. Adam shared this week's JerkFOW, which stands for the J&E Random Kidney Facts of the Week. And this one is intimately personal for him. The summer before he left for college, Adam suffered a 6-millimeter calcium oxalate kidney stone in his right ureter.
Ouch. He mentions in the newsletter that while he has obviously never birthed a child, he did assist with births during medical school. And he says the age-old medical folklore that passing a severe kidney stone is comparable to the pain of childbirth. It absolutely tracks with his experience.
I cannot even imagine. Let's break down why this actually happens without getting bogged down in too much jargon. Your body is basically a complex chemistry experiment, right?
That's a good way to look at it.
Your urine contains solutes. These are minerals and molecules like sodium, calcium, oxalate, and uric acid. And it contains a solvent, which is water.
Right.
So it's the simple, brutal equation of solutes and solvents. When you don't have enough water to keep the calcium and oxalate diluted, they just crystallize.
Exactly. If the concentration gets too high, or if your body lacks citrate, which normally acts as a chemical blocker to prevent those calcium crystals from binding a solid deposit forms.
And the physical mechanism of it is fascinating, but terrifying.
It starts deep inside the papilla tissue, which is at the tip of the kidney's inner cone. The crystal basically erodes through to the surface, anchors itself there, and just continues to grow.
Just building up over time.
Yeah. But the true agony begins when that jagged stone finally breaks off and drops into the ureter.
Which is tiny.
Very tiny. The ureter is a highly sensitive muscular tube, and it's only a few millimeters wide. It rhythmically squeezes to push fluid down to the bladder, which is a process called peristalsis.
So it's actively squeezing against the stone.
Right. When those muscles violently squeeze against a jagged 6-millimeter crystal, it triggers intense, diffuse pain pathways all over the body.
Looking at the medical guidelines, stones under 5 millimeters will usually pass on their own eventually. But a 6-millimeter stone, like Adam's, once you cross that 5-millimeter threshold, urologists often have to intervene.
They do. They have to go in with tiny instruments, including urology lasers.
Which Adam refers to as the medical pew-pew.
The medical pew-pew, right. They use those to blast the stone into sand so it can pass. And honestly, the ultimate prevention is just hydration. You have to keep the solvent levels high enough to dilute the solutes.
Drink more water, people.
Seriously. But Adam draws this brilliant historical connection here that I really love.
Oh, with Albert Barnes.
Yes. He points out that the staggering wealth generated from solving biological ailments has occasionally funded some of the most massive cultural endeavors in human history.
Right, so Albert Barnes earned his medical degree from the University of Pennsylvania at age 20, which is incredibly young. But he didn't spend his life practicing medicine.
No, he made an absolute fortune by co-developing Argyrol. It was a silver-based antiseptic. Before antibiotics existed, doctors would drip Argyrol into the eyes of newborns to prevent gonorrheal blindness.
And Barnes took the staggering wealth from that single biological treatment and bought art on a scale that is honestly hard to comprehend. We're talking 181 Renoirs, 69 Cezanne, 59 Matisses, 46 Picassos, plus works by Van Gogh and Modigliani.
It's unbelievable. Adam recently visited the Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia with that exact same 21-year-old son from the restaurant story.
Full circle moment.
Yeah. And he notes that Barnes didn't just collect art. His installation of the art was a radical act of curation in itself. He didn't hang his priceless collection chronologically. He didn't separate them by artist or by prestige.
No, he hung them in these tightly packed groups that he called ensembles. He curated them based purely on line, light, and color.
Which is so completely different from a standard museum.
Exactly. So you would have a priceless Cezanne masterpiece hung right next to wrought iron door hinges, kitchen spatulas, key plates, and Pennsylvania Dutch wooden chests.
Right, because Barnes was heavily influenced by a 30-year friendship with the philosopher John Dewey. The philosophy was that the arrangement on the wall itself is the lesson.
So what does this all mean? Barnes hanging a priceless masterpiece next to a literal door hinge is the ultimate rejection of hierarchy. It forces you to look at the shape and the light of the world, rather than just blindly worshiping the prestige of the label on the frame.
If we connect this back to the bigger picture of the newsletter, it is a really beautiful juxtaposition of the two stories. I mean, you have the painful, entirely involuntary crystallization of a kidney stone, which is just caused by a blind chemical imbalance.
Right.
And you contrast that with the deliberate philosophical crystallization of Barnes's vision on a gallery wall. His curation was intentionally heterodox. The foundation is so committed to his specific vision that when they moved to a totally new building in 2012, they precisely replicated the dimensions of his original galleries.
Wow, they recreated the exact rooms.
Right down to the angle of the south-facing windows, just to preserve his exact curatorial filter.
That is dedication to a filter. What we just talked about, enduring a painful physical trial like a kidney stone. Adam wraps up this week's notes by contrasting two radically different ways that human beings deliberately curate their motivation to put their bodies through physical endurance.
The marathon stories, yes.
Yeah. First, he looks at the Marathon du Médoc. It runs on September 5th in the French town of Pailhac, which is near Bordeaux.
And to be clear, it is a fully sanctioned official marathon. Exactly 42.195 kilometers.
A real marathon.
But the entire mechanism of motivation is just flipped on its head.
Totally flipped. The runners actually stop at 23 different chateaux along the route to drink wine.
While running.
While running. They stop and eat fresh oysters at kilometer 38. They eat steak at kilometer 39.
I can't even imagine eating steak at mile 24 of a run.
There are 8,500 runners, and 90% of them run the entire 26 miles in costume. This year's theme is the 1980s.
Oh, that's amazing.
It has nothing to do with grinding out a personal best time. It is entirely about enduring a physical challenge while joyfully indulging in life.
And Adam contrasts that joyful European approach, you know, running toward wine and oysters, with his own childhood experience in 1980s America.
Oh, boy.
Specifically, the compulsory presidential fitness test that pretty much every public school kid had to endure.
I remember the flexed arm hang. It was awful.
We all have trauma from it, right?
Yeah.
But he dug into the history, and the mechanism for why that test even existed is fascinating.
Why did it exist?
In 1955, a study was published showing that 58% of American children failed a basic physical mobility test. But compared to that, only 8.7% of European children failed.
That is a huge gap.
It is. And President Eisenhower read that statistic and viewed it not as a public health issue, but as a literal Cold War national security threat.
It's the ultimate contrast in motivation. I mean, American physical fitness driven by Cold War fear and the anxiety of national security versus European physical fitness driven entirely by hedonism and joy.
Exactly. Adam even joked that he was forced to run laps just so he wouldn't disappoint Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan, who probably couldn't run an 8-minute mile if his life depended on it.
Right. But it perfectly illustrates how the framing of a goal fundamentally changes our relationship with the activity itself.
It's another filter.
Exactly. It's a filter. Yeah. If your reality is curated by the fear of failure, you resent the run. But if your reality is curated by the promise of community, oysters, and a glass of Bordeaux, you dress up in an 80s costume and run 26 miles with a smile on your face.
We have covered so much ground today. I mean, we've explored how the messy raw data of our lives is just constantly being curated and filtered by the world around us. We saw it in the convoluted economic filters of Zepbound and the FDA's crumbling vaccine regulations.
We saw Eric Weinstein trying to filter his academic frustration into wild conspiracies.
Yeah, and we examined how outsourcing our writing to AI homogenizes our own thoughts, and how Albert Barnes radically filtered the hierarchy of art.
I want to leave you with one final detail from the very end of Adam's newsletter. For his AI Art of the Week, Adam used an LLM to generate an image summarizing the newsletter's topics.
Okay, what did he prompt it with?
He specifically asked Claude to create a Barnes-like installation, basically a gallery wall mixing different visual idioms together.
Oh, that's clever.
It's a really fascinating meta exercise, but it raises a profound final question for you to mull over. If AI tools like Claude are now summarizing our newsletters and generating visual representations of our ideas, at what point does the AI stop being our editor and start being our curator?
That is the million-dollar question.
Right. If algorithms are increasingly curating the information we consume, just like Albert Barnes curated his wall, whose philosophy are you actually absorbing without even realizing it?
That is a question that will definitely stick with me. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive. Remember, this conversation was custom tailored just for you to help you cut through the noise of an overwhelming week. We highly encourage you to go to whatadamisreading.com, click on those source links we discussed today, and do some of your own curating. Until next time, keep questioning the filters around you.